Questions about anything? So we had kind of a bit of stuff left over from talking about planets, talking about meteorites, which are rocks that fell from space. Typically, when people think about meteorites, they're thinking about iron meteorites, but they're actually a pretty rare type. Most meteorites are more ordinary sorts of stones. And most of them have these chondrules, which are little, often pea-sized spherical inclusions that indicate that they had molten material that was floating in space, that the material was melted in space. An important special type that seems to be among the most primitive sorts are the carbonaceous chondrites. So the carbon material would have evaporated if it were ever heated to really high temperatures. So it indicates that it's probably been held kind of in cold storage for the last 4.5 billion years. So achondrites are kind of important because they lack chondrules. It's kind of evidence that they did not form in space. And kind of a reasonable guess is that they are chips of the crust of a differentiated asteroid. So the idea of this is an asteroid is big enough, it's going to differentiate the way the Earth is differentiated, with the iron going to the center and the felsic material going to the crust. And if you chip off some of the crust, it would be achondrite sort of material. And the idea in this picture is the irons that are thought to be bits of one of these differentiated asteroid cores. We also have bits of Vesta, we think, because Vesta's spectra is pretty unique, and we find rocks that we can hold in our hand that match them. And the moon, which we can match up because we have our own rocks that we know were picked up on the moon. And pretty good guess that we have a handful of Martian rocks. So those are things that were chipped off by big impact craters. So typically, meteors form in showers, which are typically associated with comets. And as a matter of fact, there was a rather large comet shower with a particularly large fireball that occurred over the border of Nevada and California last week. And they show pictures of people having picked up bits of carbonaceous chondrites from that big one. So the idea is that carbonaceous chondrites probably aren't rare. If we look at the spectra of asteroids, we see that's a pretty common type out. Again, it's this game of matching spectra, so it's not ideal. But the best guess is that carbonaceous chondrites are pretty common, but they weather pretty quickly. So if you expose them to the surface of the Earth, they're going to break apart, and then they're going to be indistinguishable from other sorts of stuff. So it's nice to find them fresh. And as I say, that seems to be the case with this fall that was just last week. So, kind of in review, looking over the solar system as a whole, systematic trends, we see that pretty much everything is going around the sun in the same way in terms of planetary objects. Most of the planets are spinning the same way they're going around and have moon systems that are going around the same way. So angular momentum seems to be a pretty regular pattern in the solar system. There's a little bit of anomaly in the sun. It's going around, quote unquote, the right way, but it's doing it very slowly. So it appears as if somehow or other the sun has lost lots of its angular momentum. And it turns out that makes some sense. If we look at the other course and we look at other stars, it seems like stars are born spinning a lot faster than our sun is spinning. So there's some process that presumably slows down the spin rate of the central object. We've got this kind of natural division between the volatile stuff that's at great distances. So we have literally ice and ices out there in the Oort cloud and in the Kuiper belt. And as we move closer and closer to the furnace, we have more and more refractory materials like in Mercury. And that seems to make good sense. But remember that when we look at exoplanets, we seem to see contradictions. We see things like Jupiter that are very close to the star. And best guess as to why that's the case has to do with what's called planetary migration, that those hot Jupiters weren't formed where they were, they're formed where our Jupiter is, but then they migrated closer and closer to the star. How common that is, that's kind of up for grabs. We hope to have a better inventory of solar systems in a couple of years. Uniform composition, so it looks like everything formed from the same sort of material. We do have to adjust for escape velocity, so we think that that's why there isn't hydrogen and helium on Earth, is if there were, it would have escaped. But particularly if we look at isotope ratios, it looks like everything was formed out of one sort of stuff. Everything seems to have the standard birthday of roughly 4.5, 4.55 billion years ago. Looks like the formation of the solar system happened relatively quick, which is to say about 100 million years, presumably from this pre-solar nebula. We've seen that resonance plays kind of a surprising role. That's where we have these orbiting bodies that have exact multiples of orbital periods of other things. So we see it in the Kirkwood gaps of the asteroid belt. We see it in the moons of Jupiter. We see it in the tidally locked moons. We see it in the rings of Saturn. So it's not an uncommon occurrence to have these exact multiples. And as a matter of fact, when we look at exoplanets, we also see that resonance seems to be playing a big role in those distant solar systems. Okay, so then it was on to kind of the last big body, which is way most of the mass, and that's the sun. And we looked at the structure of the sun. At the core of the sun, that's where we have the temperatures hot enough that we can run the fusion reaction that powers the sun. And around that material, the sun is not convecting. It's still material. And what that means is that the sun is kind of festering in its own juices, that it's going to be using up all of that fuel. So 5 billion years from now, there'll be fuel just out of reach out of that central core, and it'll be starving for lack of hydrogen, and there'll be interesting futures ahead for the sun. So the outer 25% of the sun is convecting, boiling, you might say, where we have hot material rising and cool material falling. And we actually see signs of that in these granules that are on the visible surface of the sun. So that's, we usually call that the interior of the sun. It's all gas all the way down. If we look at what we might call the atmosphere of the sun, that's these three layers here. We've got the photosphere, that's the visible surface of the sun. We've got the chromosphere, we see that in eclipse. The word chromo suggests color, and we see this as red emission lines from the hydrogen gas. It's hotter than the photosphere, but not way hotter than the photosphere. And then we've got the corona, which is super hot, 2 million degrees hot, and not exactly understood why that's the case. So here's kind of the thermal structure. This is kind of backwards compared to the way we've usually done this. So here's inside the sun. As we go out, it gets cooler, cooler, and cooler, and then it starts to get a little bit hotter, and then we get this huge kind of sudden transition to real hot temperatures in the surrounding corona. Okay, so here we are, the photosphere, the visible surface of the sun at roughly speaking 6,000 degrees. We look at the interior of the sun, we've got this kind of 15 million temperature on the outside, and as you go closer and closer to the surface, it gets down to just a few thousand degrees, so way hotter on the inside. Super dense on the inside. So this is hydrogen and helium gas. It's been compressed to a density that's roughly 10 times that of gold. Huge densities on the outside, but here, even moderately close to the surface, the density of the sun is less than the density of the air in this room. And the surface of the sun, we would typically call vacuum if it were in a bottle here on Earth. This is just showing where the energy is produced. It's in this core region. And this is just showing you that stuff is being used up. So presumably the sun all started, this is by weight, with about 75% hydrogen. And we have this depletion. You know, roughly speaking, half of the hydrogen in the core has been used up as the sun has been burning for 4.5 billion years. So burning, we mean that generically. We're not talking about chemical reactions, we're talking about nuclear reactions. And actually, things are a lot simpler in nuclear reactions than they are in chemical reactions. If you were to look at a molecule of trinitrotoluene, TNT, it would kind of be hard put to say that that's a high energy molecule. Whereas the situation for nuclei is surprisingly simple and maybe exaggerated on that graph I did here. Here's the actual data. They've plotted it upside down compared to how I have, so this is kind of the equivalent. I guess I want to also reverse it this way. So we have high energy molecules here that are like hydrogen and helium, and we have high, relatively high energy molecules like uranium, and the most stable stuff is iron. I'll bring it back to the way they plotted it, where negative energy is going up as opposed to down. So the most stable stuff is iron 56. And if we take this small stuff and build it up, we can release energy. If we take big stuff and break it apart, we can get energy. So taking big stuff and breaking apart is called fission. Taking small stuff and putting it together is called fusion. And you know, quite naturally, since the sun is made out of small stuff like hydrogen and helium, it's fusion that powers the sun. So the overall reaction, sometimes called hydrogen burning, is that four protons get together and they produce a normal helium, helium-4, and in the process release two antimatter electrons and two neutrinos. Step by step, this is what happens. We've got two protons coming together to form deuterium. And what's happening is that one of the up quarks that is in the proton is spontaneously becoming a down quark, and in the process emitting an antimatter electron and a neutrino. And so we end up then with a nucleus that has a proton and a neutron that are bound together. And this is a very slow process. This is a very unlikely reaction to occur. It's a reaction that has never been duplicated in laboratories just because it's so incredibly rare. When you throw these things together, 99.9999999% of the time, they just bounce off each other. It takes a good bit of luck in order to have them stick and to have the proton turn into a neutron. The rest of the reactions go relatively quick. The deuterium will pick up a proton to form helium-3. And actually, there are lots of ways this reaction can terminate. This isn't the only way. But the most common way is two of these helium-3s come together and form helium-4, and in the process release two hydrogens. Okay, so the rate-limiting step is getting these two protons together, and the reason it's slow is because the hydrogens are repelled by each other. It also requires the weak force in order for it to happen, whereas the other ones are dominated by the strong force. Okay, so that's where so-called energy production is occurring. We're taking high energy fuel like protons and converting it to slightly less energy fuel, helium. And there's a long way we could go, right? So helium can burn to carbon and oxygen, and we can work our way all the way up to iron 56 and release energy all the way. But going to helium-4 is a good piece. You can see it's most of the energy that you have to release. Going from helium-4 to carbon-12 and oxygen, which is kind of the next step, isn't going to release nearly as much energy as just going to helium. But all of these processes occur in various sorts of stars. Questions?
For the temperature of the corona, is that anything like the thermosphere where, like, or the thermosphere of Earth where, like, it's like, I think the book said the thermosphere wouldn't actually seem that hot even though the temperature's high because there's not as many particles?
Well, it's not just, it's pretty much required that there couldn't be much there if it's going to be at those sorts of high temperatures because there isn't any pressure to confine it. So it's kind of no surprise if it's going to be hot, it's going to be low density. But low density by itself doesn't cut it, doesn't cause that effect. So even if you put low density gas in your oven and set the thermostat for 400 degrees, the gas just goes to 400 degrees. It doesn't go to 2 million degrees. So it's something of a puzzle exactly what's heating the corona. And the fact that there isn't much there means that it doesn't take a lot of heat. But whatever is heating it has to itself have a temperature that is 2 million degrees or hotter. And so where is it 2 million degrees or hotter? Well, I don't know if we have a nice graph of that we can read or not. The answer is the boundary between the radiation zone and the, you know, you can see kind of right about here is where you're going to hit 2 million degrees. So the idea is that things are being stirred up deep here in the sun, and somehow or other, that energy is working its way through a hell of a lot of stuff in order to reach the corona and heat it up. So whatever it is that's going from there to there, this sun has to look transparent to it. So it can't be light. It can't be any sort of light. This material is opaque to light. And really the only candidate is something like sound. Right? Because sound can go through solids, liquids, gases just fine without being attenuated. That's how we learn about the interior of the Earth. And in a second, we'll say that's how we learn about the interior of the sun. So I say something like sound because this is a magnetized plasma, and magnetic fields have big effect on plasma. And things are a little bit more complicated than the waves we can get just in the air in this room. We can get a whole wide spectrum of waves in a plasma. And so often what's said is kind of a shorthand, as you can think of there being kind of a super rock concert here, and it's so loud that when those sound waves crash here in the outer regions of the sun's atmosphere, that it heats it up. And that's kind of a nice story, but it's not exactly correct. They can't literally be sound waves. It's got to be one of these other magnetic waves that is able to work its way through all of that material. And the details of how that work are unknown, but it has to work that way. It has to have a source that is 2 million degrees hot. And boy, the boundary of the radiation zone and the convection zone is just the right temperature and has kind of the right conditions, turbulent mixing that you would expect that would cause those sorts of waves.
For the hydrogen reaction where you turn it into deuterium, are there any electrons involved?
So all this material is ionized. Okay. So there are always as many electrons around as there are protons, but they're not going to be associated with those protons. At these very high temperatures, the material is fully ionized.
Okay, so then at the very end, when the two hydrogens split off, they can still make the same reaction again?
Yeah, oh yeah. There's nothing any different about those final two hydrogens than there were about the initial ones.
So then how come the hydrogen is supposed to be being used up?
Well, it's being used up because if you look at that reaction, what's gone into it is 6 protons. Yeah, so here we have 2, and then we added another one here, so that's 3, and we ran this reaction twice, so that's 6. So 6 protons get in, 4 of them essentially end up here, and 2 of them just come out to be recycled. So this is using up hydrogen. More questions?
I know how they have a fusion reactor experimentation in Europe. So what do they do with the leftover material? Is it like nuclear waste then?
Well, by definition, it's nuclear and it's waste. But typically when people say that, they're thinking about stuff that's radioactive. So for a fission reactor, when you roughly speaking, for most elements, there are about as many neutrons as there are protons. You can kind of think of neutrons as being the glue that's required to hold things together. But it turns out that out here for these big nuclei, there are an extra number of neutrons. So for uranium, you remember it's 92 protons and 235 total. So I don't know, whatever that works out to be, 130, 140 neutrons for those 90 protons. So when we break it apart, we don't have this about equal mix of neutrons and protons that is normal. And because it has too many neutrons, the products of that reaction, they're going to be radioactive materials. And they will decay down to the normal mix of neutrons will convert themselves into protons to get back to the roughly right level of number of neutrons equals number of protons. So the products of fission are always radioactive. The products of fusion are helium. Right? And helium is kind of by definition the most inert thing you can think of. So the products, the direct products of fusion are not going to be radioactive. Now, there are a couple of things that, since you bring up controlled Earth-based fusion, We're not going to do it this way, right? Right, because that takes too long. So what they use, turns out that you can see that these deuteriums are way more reactive than these hydrogens. So instead of using hydrogen-hydrogen, they're going to the plan is to use deuterium-tritium. So those guys are much more reactive than the bare protons, and you can run this reaction then at a much lower temperature and density than you have in the inside of the sun, and have it happen at a reasonable rate. One important difference between the reactions that involve deuterium and tritium, D and T, is that they produce neutrons. And that's problematical because those neutrons will run into something eventually, and they'll typically be absorbed by the nucleus, and then we have a disbalance again between the number of neutrons and the number of protons. So let's say we have an iron wall that's surrounding the fusion reaction, and neutrons are going to be going through that wall. So occasionally the iron will grab a neutron and it'll become radioactive. Okay, so the direct products of fusion are not radioactive, but indirectly they're going to make the material in the reactor radioactive. It turns out that for various reasons, basically because they're not out of balance by very much, just one neutron, whereas these guys from fusion are way out of balance. So it turns out that the half-lives that are involved out of the wall material that has been made radioactive, instead of being 1,000 years, is more like 100 years. So it's not a zero problem, but it's maybe 10% or 1% of the similar problem that you have in fission reactors. But there are huge other problems with controlled fusion. The fuel is cheap, and everything maybe looks good from that sort of sense, but people have been working on it now for about 50 years, and no one's made money on it yet. So it's a very tough problem to solve. So the international test reactor that is that's being built in Europe is supposed to be the first one that actually produces more energy than it uses. And it's still not something that's going to be hooked up to NSP. It's very much a scientific program. So I wouldn't bet on any fusion company stocks for a long time. 20 years, 30 years, something like that, maybe. But it's been around for a long time. The usual joke is that fusion will be the energy of the future now and forever, that we're never going to achieve the desired goal of having this relatively pollution-free source of energy with limitless possibilities, because there's plenty of deuterium in the ocean, so you're not going to have to go to Saudi Arabia to get your fuel. But not anytime soon. I think I'd be willing to bet not in my lifetime, but maybe in yours. Questions? More questions? Well, so a magnetic field, a lot of these structures that we see on the surface of the sun are dominated by magnetic fields. So we talked about sunspots, which are just relatively, you know, maybe 1,000 degrees cooler than the so-called surface of the sun. This is material that is not taking part in the convection, so it's not getting stirred around, so it's able to cool off. And relative to the very hot surface, it looks dark, right? But it's brighter than anything you've ever seen, aside from the sun. We've got prominences, which are often, doesn't look like in this picture, are often loop-shaped structures that are where we have chromospheric material that's being held aloft in the corona, often producing nice red lights. We have flares, which are explosive events, and coronal mass ejections, CMEs, which are kind of super flares, which blow off a good bit of, a very small amount, but a noticeable amount of material. And if that material runs into the Earth, then we have a good possibility of having aurora on Earth. So we've got spicules, which are kind of like grass fingers that are chromospheric material that is sticking up Granules, those are the top of the convection cells. Filaments are actually prominences that are seen not on the edge of the sun, but on the looking down on them in the surface of the sun. And the energy mechanism is so-called magnetic recombination. So there is energy in any magnetic field, and if we have opposite magnetic fields and they annihilate each other, then that energy has to go someplace, and it goes into producing these flares. Nope. Other questions? Okay, so I want to spend a good part of today answering what I think seems like a funny question, and that is, why doesn't the sun explode? And I have a hard time convincing people that this is an interesting question, because of course, if we're looking for an example of something that is stable, it sure seems to be the sun, right? It's going to rise every day. People usually are willing to bet on that. So I need to convince you that this is a reasonable question. So I need to convince you that explosions are usual. But that is also usually a pretty hard sell, because the only explosions you usually see are when you buy a firecracker or something like that. So why haven't I seen an explosion recently? So once I've convinced you that explosions are usual, and the only reason you haven't seen one recently, those reasons don't apply to the sun, then maybe I can convince you that it's interesting to see why the sun doesn't explode. And the answer is going to be a theorem, the virial theorem. Okay, so why are explosions the usual case? And the reason has to do with positive feedback. So this term feedback, I'm sure, is one that you're familiar with. If you go to a rock concert or something like that, we've got loudspeakers, and we've got mics, and we've got amplifiers that feed the speaker. And if we're not careful, what happens is a random sound is picked up with the mic, and it's amplified. It comes out the speaker, and it's amplified again and again and again and again. And in a short period of time, all of the power of the amplifier is just made reproducing this sound. So the existence of positive feedback is a situation where a little bit leads to more. If you have that sort of situation, then you have the thing set up for some sort of exponential growth that is the hallmark of positive feedback. So what's involved with explosions that are in that sort of situation? So if we're talking about explosions on Earth, we're of course talking about chemical reactions. And of course in the sun we're talking about nuclear reactions, but it really doesn't make any particular difference to the dynamics of what's going on. In chemical reactions or in nuclear reactions, in order to have a reaction, what we have to have is two things coming together. Right? You can't burn the fuel if you don't get the stuff coming together. And what's going to happen, of course, is that typically there's some sort of minimum energy that they have to come together for in order to actually react. So for example, if you probably have sugar sitting on your kitchen table, but if you put a match to that sugar, it'll burn. There's some amount of energy that's required in order to get this thing started. So some minimum amount of energy is typically required in order to start this process. So the wood can stand outside forever without burning, but when you get it hot enough, it'll start to react. Well, once things get together and they actually react, what they're going to do is to produce energy. I shouldn't say produce energy, I guess I should say release energy. The energy was there to start with in the form of the particular chemical bonds. And if you release energy, what's going to happen is you're going to increase the temperature. And if you increase the temperature, what's going to happen is the atoms are going to move faster. And if we have the atoms moving faster, there are going to be more collisions per second. And you can see that that's going to lead to two things coming together more frequently. So once we get this process going, the first reaction is going to lead to release of energy, the temperature is going to go up, we're going to have more atoms reacting, more collisions, and there's no end in sight until we've used up all the fuel. So if you think about the standard oven leaking natural gas sort of explosion, we have a room then that has natural gas and oxygen, and we get a little bit of flame going, and it's going to get reactions going in the immediate vicinity of that flame, which is going to get reactions going, heating up a larger version, until this whole room, all of the fuel is going to be used up.
So how come a log of wood doesn't just explode then?
Yeah, why doesn't it just explode, since explosions are usual?
There's a lot of small reactions maybe.
Well, so
a lot of material.
One common thing that you maybe have heard of, you typically hear about it a couple of times a year exploding, are silos or flour mills. And what could be more unreactive than flour, right? Throw it on the table, it certainly doesn't seem to be at all dangerous. But if you throw it up in the air, if you distribute it throughout the room, it makes a really nice explosion. Right? So flour sitting in a cup is not explosive because there's only so much surface area that stuff can get to. But once you distribute that flour throughout the room, then there's lots of places where things can get together. So we have homogeneous material. So a wood log is hard to get to burn because there's only so much surface area, and the only place the reactions can occur is on that interface between the oxygen and the wood. The bulk of the wood can't burn because there's no oxygen in there, and of course the oxygen can't burn because there's no wood there. So only on the interface can we actually have reactions occurring. So that's an important reason for why we haven't seen one recently. Typically, if we're thinking about chemicals burning, we need a fuel and we need oxygen. We need both. And we keep them in separate places. We don't fill up our kitchens with an equal mix of oxygen and natural gas. Right? We put the natural gas in a bottle and we let the oxygen roam around in the air. The reverse would work fine too. Right? So if you wanted to explore Titan, remember there are lots of hydrocarbons there, you're going to keep the oxygen in your tank and you don't have to worry about exploding as long as it's separated from the methane and ethane that's filling the atmosphere. So it doesn't matter which one you tank up, but you're going to keep them separate. Okay, and if they're not kept separate, then they are going to explode, and the Earth has been around for 4.5 billion years. It probably already occurred, and all we have left is ash. So another way of saying it is the cavemen who didn't keep their fuel and their oxygen separated, they didn't survive. So now we've learned the lesson, and we keep our oxygen and our fuel in separate containers. So I hope you see that none of these things are going to help us with the sun, because the sun doesn't require two separate things. It just requires one thing. And you can't keep something separate from itself. But otherwise, it's the same process, right? We need two things to get together. They're going to release energy. It's going to make the temperature go up. The atoms are going to move faster. We're going to get more collisions per second. And the whole thing blows up. And you know it blows up because we have hydrogen bombs, which do exactly that. So the process only stops when either the fuel is all used up or the material has blown itself so it's so widely separated that it can no longer burn. So why doesn't the sun explode? It seems to have everything that's required. And it may be helpful to realize that some stars do. Now, generally speaking, it's a rare occurrence for the same reason that it's a rare occurrence on Earth, right? If it could happen, it did happen, you know, 10 billion years ago. So when a star becomes unstable, when it has the possibility of having this positive feedback cycle, it's going to go boom within a millisecond or so. So the only out has to be to get rid of this positive feedback cycle. So there must be something that doesn't apply to the sun. But two things come together, they release energy, it increases the temperature, things move faster. It's kind of hard to see where we can break this cycle. And I think if you think about it, there's only one place, but boy, it seems very unlikely, and that's here. Right? Temperature always makes things move faster. And if things are moving faster, there are always more collisions. You're going to have more reactions, and those reactions are going to release energy. So is there any case where you add energy to something and it gets cooler? I don't think so. Negative specific heat. Well, that's what the virial theorem says is true. So the virial theorem says that this is not the case under some circumstances. So it's a mathematical theorem. It's got hypotheses and it's got conclusions. And the hypotheses, that's what's required for the virial theorem. And of course, these things can't exist very frequently on Earth, or else we'd see things that when you put them in the microwave, they got cold. Right? So the if part. So if you're made out of gas, and I should maybe put in a proviso here, you're made out of normal gas. Apparently there are abnormal gases, or I wouldn't bother to say that. And if you're held together by gravity, so under those circumstances, with those hypotheses, you can prove the following conclusion. If you add energy, the result is the temperature goes down. Right? So if the Enterprise fires its phaser into this, what happens is the star gets colder. And on the other hand, if you remove energy, the result is the temperature goes up. So you drop an iceberg in the sun, and the result is the sun gets hotter. This doesn't sound credible. Right? Conservation of energy, right? So if I add energy, the thermal energy can't decrease, or at least the energy has to go someplace else. So if the thermal energy is going down, the only possibility is the potential energy has to increase. It has to increase more than the thermal energy goes down. It's the only possibility. And the way the way the potential energy can increase, of course, if the material just gets higher in the star. That is to say, if the radius of the star increases, if the star is lifted up internally, if it expands out as a result of this process, then it's at least possible. So if I remove energy and I get more thermal energy, then it must mean that the potential energy goes down more than the thermal energy went up. And I can do that by having the star become more compressed. So with a little bit of calculus, we could prove this. It's not a super hard theorem to prove, but that's kind of not the point in this class. But I do want to try and convince you that there's something about this that makes some sense, because it kind of makes no sense. And what I'd like you to think about is a spacecraft that's orbiting the Earth. And the reason to think about that is because the atoms that are in the sun are orbiting the sun. Right? They're subjected to gravitational pull. They're orbiting. And so a spaceship is a perfectly good model for an atom inside the sun. So what happens if we add energy to the spacecraft, right? So we fire our rocket engines to increase our energy. And what happens is the orbit expands out, right? You fire your rockets like this to get further away from the Earth, and you slow down. Right? The moon is going slower miles per hour than a spacecraft is, right? It takes the moon, even though it's in a bigger path, so you might think that that's adjusting for it, but it takes it a month to go around as opposed to 90 minutes to go around in low Earth orbit. So we add energy, and we end up going slower. And atomic speed is, of course, a measurement of the speed of the energies. And contrary-wise, if we fire our retro rockets, if we try and reduce our energy, what happens is we go to a closer in orbit, and that means we're going faster. So if we lose energy, we end up going faster. And of course, the contradiction to conservation of energy is made up for. We're going faster, we have more kinetic energy, but we have twice as much loss of potential energy so that they still add up. Right? So if I take away one, I increase my kinetic energy by one, and the potential energy goes down by 2, and it still adds up. And it turns out it's exactly that 2-to-1 ratio between the potential energy and the kinetic energy that's involved with gravity. Okay, and you can see that does exactly what we need. It's going to turn positive feedback into negative feedback. Right, so negative feedback is like when you slap your dog because it's behaving badly, right? So it learns that that's not a good thing to do. And what happens now is if we try and get this reaction going, if we add energy, the temperature is going to go down, and it's exactly what's required to decrease the energy production. So we can get stable burning as opposed to exponentially growing behavior. So why haven't we seen this effect on Earth, given that it's not that hard to prove? Well, we certainly have things that are made of gas, right? You can buy a balloon full of gas, but that balloon full of gas isn't held together by gravity. It's held together by the rubber membrane that's around it. Why doesn't it apply to the astronauts that are orbiting in space? They're not made out of a gas, and they're not held together by gravity, right? They're held together by chemical forces. Right? But boy, this is a perfect definition of a star. Right? Made out of gas and held together by gravity. What could be a better definition of a star? How about Jupiter? Made out of gas, held together by gravity. Why doesn't it explode? Well, it turns out one good reason by itself is that Jupiter simply isn't hot enough to start these reactions going. But even more important, turns out that Jupiter isn't made out of a normal gas. That there's another possibility that's called a degenerate gas. And to be a degenerate gas, what you need to be is highly compressed. And have a relatively low temperature. Okay, so sun doesn't explode because it's made out of a normal gas and it's held together by gravity, so we have turned positive feedback into negative feedback so we can have stable burning. Stars that do explode, they must violate this theorem. Well, they're all made out of, they're all held together by gravity, so it must be the gas that they're made of that's different. So if a star can go from being made out of a normal gas into a degenerate gas, that's when we have to start worrying about it exploding. And it can do that, of course, just by reaching higher and higher densities without getting too hot. All these stars are very hot on the inside, but they also are at extraordinarily high densities. So there's a competition between density and temperature that goes on inside of stars. And stars that do explode, they go too much in the density direction and not enough in the temperature direction, and then they go boom. Incidentally, the sun will go through that process, but the explosion that it will encounter will not be enough to disrupt it. Of course, by this time, we're all very much long dead. The sun will have expanded and the Earth will become a cinder. So we better be well outside of the region. But in any case, the sun will have an explosion of the gas at its core, but it turns out it'll be a totally contained explosion. The mass of the sun will hold it together, so it won't break apart. Other stars very much do totally disrupt themselves. And kind of the most common cases of that are called supernovas. So out at the observatory, not uncommonly, I'm taking data on exploding stars from other galaxies, which are interesting things to look at. Okay. So usually things on Earth don't explode because we don't mix the fuel and the oxygen together. But if you throw the flower in the air and light a match, I should say don't do this at home, although it's fun to do at home. I've done it at home. It makes a very nice explosion. I used to demonstrate it here, except now with these carpeted floors, it's a real mess to clean up. Because not all the flour burns, right? You're going to end up with lots of flour on the floor. There are nice YouTube videos of it, though. Okay, so I want to come back and talk a little bit more about these magnetic phenomena. So I think I talked briefly before about the solar cycle, that currently, this is a somewhat early slide. I showed you a more recent slide that showed that we've just come through a minimum, kind of like this, in the number of sunspots on the surface of the sun, and the plan was to go to ever more spots. And the kind of period that's involved in this process is about 11 years. And what this is really representing is a change in the magnetization of the sun. So it turns out that, you know, that the Earth's magnetic poles change, but on a time scale of 1 million years or so. For the sun, it's a magnetic object. It has a conducting convected fluid, right? We know that. So it has a corresponding magnetic field. And this magnetic field spontaneously reverses on a kind of 11-year cycle. So every 11 years, if whatever was a north pole becomes a south pole and vice versa. So to go through a complete cycle, north pole goes to south, gets back to the original situation. It's a 22-year cycle. There's also a corresponding change in where the sunspots are. So this here is a sunspot minimum where we have relatively few sunspots. The ones that had existed before have died out and we haven't grown new ones. And where we will first see sunspots is at relatively high latitudes, and then they'll move towards the equator, and then we'll have relatively few, and then we'll start the whole process again. So this pattern is sometimes called the butterfly pattern because it shows kind of where the sunspots are on the surface of the sun. So the other thing I want to come back to are these neutrinos. So we've got a couple of puzzles about the sun, and we want to cover them kind of one by one. We have the hot corona, and I guess what I've said is that the answer has to be magnetic waves from the boundary between the radiative zone and the convection zone. The details of that problem aren't exactly worked out. Another problem kind of corresponds to my scientific life, and it's called the solar neutrino problem. So these are things that we don't understand about the sun, or maybe didn't understand about the sun, I should say. So what we've said is that in order for the sun to run, every time we produce a helium, we should produce two neutrinos. And we know how much helium is being produced because we know how much energy the sun is releasing from its surface. Presumably, it's producing that same amount of energy in its interior. Incidentally, it might be worth remembering that the energy that's produced in the reactions at the core of the sun take a long time to work their way out, right? So in this radiation zone, we have the light from these reactions, and it's going to bounce around for a considerable period of time before it reaches the convective zone and can then be pumped to the surface. So people have speculated that maybe the sun is turned off, that maybe it's not producing nuclear energy. It's just kind of coasting based on energy that it had in the past. This is a possibility. We don't believe that currently. So the solar neutrino problem is that we think we know how many neutrinos are supposed to be produced. Two neutrinos per helium. And we think we know how much helium is being produced. So in 1960, they calculated how many neutrinos should be going through your body every second. And it's zillions of neutrinos per second. But of course, those neutrinos are highly non-interacting. So even though they're going through you all the time, they never hit anything. So they don't do any damage. But as a test of seeing whether we really understood how the system worked, Ray Davies decided that he would try and measure these solar neutrinos. So these things, generally speaking, don't react with anything like a body-sized object. So if there's any chance of detecting them, you need a huge tank of something. And if you're going to have a huge tank of something, it better be cheap because you have to fill it up. So he filled up this big tank with cleaning fluid. And that cleaning fluid was rich in chlorine, something like carbon tetrachloride, although I hope it wasn't carbon tetrachloride. And what happens is extremely rarely, right, so we have neutrinos that are going through this tank all the time. Extremely rarely what happens is that neutrino can hit the chlorine and you can have the reverse reaction that we talked about before. And we can have the chlorine changed into argon. nucleus. So argon's a inert gas that you can hope to find. And what he calculated is that something like 30 argon atoms were going to be produced every month in this huge tank. So talk about a needle in a haystack. Seems incredible that you could detect 30 atoms in the biggest tank of cleaning fluid you could afford. But you can, and he did. But he didn't find 30, he found 10. So roughly one-third of the expected number of neutrinos were detected. So that's why people were thinking about, you know, maybe the sun is turned off now, because we certainly doesn't seem to be producing nearly the number of neutrinos it would take. So incidentally, you do need to shield this tank. So this was done in an old gold mine in Lead, is it North or South Dakota? A fraction of a mile underground. And so every month they'd go through and they'd count the number of argon atoms that had been created in the last month. And year after year after year, this started in the early 60s, year after year after year, there were not enough. And when your experiment produces unexpected results, particularly when it's as complicated an experiment as this, and you know, people are pretty sure they understood how the sun works, people suspected that he was making some sort of subtle mistake. So this happens all the time in science. People think they understand what they're doing, and not through incompetence, because things are really tough. They make mistakes. So kind of famously, 6 months ago, some group announced that they thought neutrinos traveled faster than the speed of light. And it looks like they had some faulty connections that caused the incorrect result. So I don't know, a few times a year we have famous cases of misinterpreted results, and the facts are that this happens way more frequently than hits the news media. Only when it's interesting, like neutrinos traveling faster than the speed of light and Einstein being wrong, do people bother to report these missed events. Luckily, right? Otherwise we'd be embarrassed if they reported all our mistakes. So this has been a hot problem for 40 years. And people made new and different types of detectors. They did this, repeated it with literally exactly the same sort of stuff. The Russians did this, Europeans did this, and everyone came up short. And it was really hard put to explain how that could be happening. So it turned out one possibility is maybe the sun wasn't as warm as we thought on the inside, but then it's hard to see how it would be producing as much energy. And in the last 10 years, we think we've figured this out, and the problem isn't with the sun, and it isn't with the cleaning fluid, it's with the stuff that's between the two. So it turns out that neutrinos, unlike particles that you're used to, the technical word for it is oscillate. And what this means is that a neutrino can spontaneously decide to become something else. And so it's pretty funny, right? So a proton can suddenly decide it's going to be a positron, and then a little while later it changes its mind again and becomes a proton. So the neutrinos that are being produced inside the sun at the expected rate, but two-thirds of them have oscillated to something else, typically another sort of neutrino, and hence there are only one-third of the original neutrinos to be detected in the cleaning fluid. So the solar neutrino problem, I would say, seems to be solved at this point. There are a lot of details to be worked out, like exactly the rate at which these neutrinos oscillate into their other types. We know about 60% of the required oscillation rates, but we don't know all of them yet. But seems to be a perfectly consistent explanation for the solar neutrino problem. And Ray Davies got his Nobel Prize, but still when it was unsolved. So how do we know this, these interior structures that I've claimed? How do we get this data? And I think I've told you in the past that we probably know the interior conditions inside the sun better than we know the interior conditions inside the Earth. And we know it by exactly the same phenomena. It's seismic waves. So sound is the only thing that can penetrate this object to any great distances. And if we can detect the vibrations on the surface of the sun, we're all set to use the same process we use to figure out the interior of the Earth to apply it to the sun. And it seems pretty unlikely that we could do that, because these vibrations that are constantly occurring on the sun, these seismic waves, as it were, are not going to be any bigger than Earth seismic waves. But because the surface of the sun is sometimes moving towards the Earth and sometimes moving away from the Earth, the light that it produces is going to be Doppler shifted. Now, it's an incredibly small amount, right? So when I walk towards this light, it doesn't seem to be changing color. But of course, it is changing color very, very slightly. If you're approaching an object, the wavelengths are going to be shifted a little bit to the blue. If you're receding from an object, they're going to be shifted to a little bit to the red. And these speeds that we're talking about are comparable to walking speeds. So it takes very sensitive detectors in order to detect these very small vibrations. But once you've done it, you can simultaneously measure the vibrations on half of the surface of the sun, which you can't cover the Earth with that many seismic stations, because of course most of the Earth is water, so it just sinks to the bottom anyway. But we can do it for the sun. So we have very good data on the interior of the sun. And one of the things that we now have really good answer to has to do with the rotation of the sun. So remember we said that the sun seems to be rotating slower than you would expect. Right? So it has a rotation period of about a month, whereas Jupiter, for example, has a rotation period of about 10 hours. And of course, for the Earth, it's 24 hours. So you would expect, actually, naively, that the angular momentum would follow the mass, and so that the sun should be rotating rapidly. And when we look at young stars, they are rotating rapidly. So how does this all work out for the sun? And there's an additional fly in the ointment, as it were, for the sun. And that is to say that the rotation period of the sun doesn't seem to even be a constant. So this work goes back basically to Galileo. The way you're going to calculate the rotation period of the sun is you're going to follow a sunspot and time how long it takes to go around the sun. It turns out that it's a pretty long, typically sunspots last only a few weeks. So it takes a good long sunspot that you can actually watch to go all the way around the sun. But you can figure out the rotation rate. And what was found 4 centuries ago is that it takes less time to go around the sun at the equator than it takes to go around at higher latitudes. So the sun isn't rotating like a solid object. It has different rotation speeds at different places. So one way that maybe makes it sound not so strange is to say that it's got a super rotating equatorial jet. Right? We've used those words a lot.
Does the sun have a magnetic field that we could track?
So the sun has a great magnetic field, bigger than the Earth's magnetic field, but that's not, and of course I guess you're thinking that that's how we do it for Jupiter. We measure its rotation rate. By that sort of process. But no, I haven't heard of anyone using that for the sun. So you're saying that if we did that, repeating what's behind your question, we do exactly the same thing for Jupiter, right? It's got no solid surface, so we time cloud features in the atmosphere and we get different speeds for different latitudes, and we declare that the rotation rate for Saturn is based on how long its magnetic field takes to rotate. So So it makes good sense, I guess, to apply that to the sun, but I've never heard that done for the sun. I can think of various reasons why. It turns out that the plasma that's between us and the sun kind of protects us from the magnetic field of the sun. So usually when I say that we've detected the magnetic field of the sun, we don't do it by going, 100 miles up and seeing what the magnetic field is there, because it's strongly influenced by the Earth's magnetic field. We wouldn't see it vary. They actually do it spectroscopically. So if you look at a piece of the sun, the magnetic field slightly changes the energy levels of those atoms, and so instead of absorbing at 4,621.3211 angstroms, that number will be shifted slightly. So by measuring that slight shift, we can measure the magnetic field right there on the surface of the sun. So that's typically how it's been done. More questions? Okay, so the sun, said one way, it seems to have some sort of equatorial jet so that the gas is rotating faster at the equator than it's rotating at other spots. Well, what is the speed of rotation? And again, early on people thought that if the brakes had been put on the sun, so remember we think the sun started out rotating fast, if God put his hands on the sun to slow it down, that might slow down the outer part, but it's just gas, so the inner part could be spinning at high speed just fine. So maybe the inside of the sun is spinning at a lot higher speed than the outer parts of the sun. There are other reasons to suspect that was the case. But since we can use these seismic sensors to look inside the sun, what we find is that this differential rotation only occurs as deep as the convection zone. And that kind of makes sense. It's convection that is associated with weather, which is associated with the sort of jet streams. So once we go below the convection zone, then the sun seems to be rotating as a solid object. And we have, I don't remember, I think I didn't show you that slide before, maybe I'll show it to you next time, that shows good data on what the rotation rate is inside the sun at various latitudes. And if I were guessing what the situation is in Jupiter, you might remember that some people think that the rotation rates of Jupiter actually go right through the planet in these sort of cylinders. Do you remember that? So that the zones and belts in the northern hemisphere would be connected to the zones and belts in the southern hemisphere. So the fact that we know that that's not the case in the sun is one of the reasons I don't believe that that's the case with Jupiter. That probably the differential rotation in Jupiter, just like in the sun, probably only goes as deep as the convection zone in the sun, or the convection zone in Jupiter. Okay. Anything else I wanted to say about the sun? I think there are a handful of more things I want to say about the sun, but I don't think we have time to get very far with them. So I think I'll call it quits at this point. So I'll have maybe 15 more minutes of things to say about the sun next time. And then we'll be done with geology and meteorology, and maybe it'll be time to start talk about biology.